we're okay. This is Wendy Smith recording Paul Hawes on the 18th of March, and we are talking about being a soldier. Okay, so if you would like to start off, what made you enlist, or was it conscription?
Well, I knew I'd got to do my national service when I was 18, and my best mate, Ray Chamberlain, said he was going to join the army and he was going to join the Royal Artillery. And I said, I think I'll come with you. I was 17 and a half, and he was about the same age as me, so we went up to the recruiting office at Mill Road in Cambridge, and we signed on, joined the army, but I didn't know a lot because I hadn't had much schooling, and I couldn't even spell my second name. And when the recruiting sergeant said, fill this form in, I put Paul, but when I come to Reginald, I was stuck. So he told me how to spell Reginald. So my name is Paul Reginald Hawes. And so we joined the army. We got travel warrants to go to Oswestry in Shropshire. And we was there. The day I joined the army was the 1st of April 1953, April Fool's Day.
Yeah.
And we got travel warrants to go to Shropshire, Oswestry. We was there for a fortnight while we were selected and sent to different training units, got kitted out, everything, tin hats, gas masks, two uniforms, boots, gaiters, the whole lot. And after a fortnight, Ray and I got posted to the Royal Artillery Regiment, training regiment at Rhyl in North Wales.
Did you get allocated, or were you able to ask for preference?
We had a form to fill in, I believe. And depending on our educational standard, you were sort of selected. Yeah, that's right. And Ray and I we had the choice to be predictor operators, which was with the heavy AK, or signallers in the field artillery. So we asked for to be signallers in the field artillery. So we went to the signal training regiment at Rhyl. Also on part of the same camp was a Royal Artillery driving school where they learnt to drive, and the gun numbers, the gun crews went to some other place to be trained. And we had 6 weeks in North Wales, learning to lay lines, learning to use the field telephones, learning to use the 19 set.
What's the 19 set?
19 set is a big radio which takes two of you to lift it. It has four really big batteries. Each battery is what much as one man want to carry. But now I just have mobile phones and sort of hand. And this was a 19 set which they use for fire orders. Part of the Royal Artillery's training is for fire orders when you have an OP officer up on the front with the infantry and the gun's about 5 miles behind, and he radios down to the gun position, and what they do is they get one gun fires a range and shot, he sends all map references and all other data down over the radio or the field telephone, and one gun does a range and shot, and if it's pretty near the target or how near to the target it is, he'll say go left 100 yards or up 100 yards, and this gun and all the other guns will alter their angles, then they'll just perhaps send another range and shot, and if it's on the target, he'd just say five rounds of gunfire.
So you are on the front line with the guns behind you?
The observation post was right up in the front line with the infantry.
Oh, right.
You had an OP officer, observation officer, and a signaller. And the command post for the guns would be 4 or 5 miles behind. Depends on the size of the gun. Medium guns would be 8 or 9 miles behind. And the 4.2 mortars, which I was with in Egypt, there was just about a mile away. And that's what we've done. We've done a training. When we was about to go, we had so many rumours about the army. You tell you, it was all day on the barracks square, left, right, and marching up and down and that. But for the whole 6 weeks, we only had 45 minutes a day marching and rifle drill. And in that time, we had about a 15 minutes break for a cigarette. So we didn't have much. But then we had a parsnip parade. We were sort of half soldiers then. We got all the kit sorted out. We'd got our boots balled up and our belt and gaiters blank out. And we'd all had a regimental haircut. And that was, around about August, I should think, then. I was put on a draft from that regiment. We was allocated to a proper regiment. This was a training regiment. I was put on a draft to go to Lark Hill on Salisbury Plain. And I don't know. And the reason was because I wasn't 18. I joined at 17 and a half, and I wasn't 18 in April, and I wasn't 18 until September. So, as luck had it, that must have been luck, I'd come out with a really bad rash 2 or 3 days before we was being shipped out of Rill towards Woolwich, the depot, and they put me in the isolation ward. So the rest of them went and I was left there. So the next, about a fortnight later, I was put on a draft to Egypt, the Canal Zone. And all my mates and colleagues said, you needn't go because you're not 18. I said, well, I'm going now. So I come home, got to the depot at Woolwich. We got a fortnight's embarkation leave. Come home and I said to mother, I'm going to Egypt. She said, oh, there's a lot of trouble out there. Which it was.
Which way you go?
It was. So
Did she actually say don't go? Or
No. She just worried like other mothers do, I suppose. And after my fortnight's embarkation leave, by that time, Ray and I got parted. He had been sent to Plymouth with a heavy ACAC unit, and I think he'd done most of his time in Plymouth.
Oh,
then,
right.
Then I got honestly a draft to the Canal Zone, to 181 Independent Light Battery, Royal Artillery, and we was flown out. Before we was flown out, we went to a transit depot in Goode Street in London, which was in a deep shelter, and there was a spiral staircase 240 steps down. It was, they said it was a deep shelter, but you could see hear the tubes running by you up, and it was just
like one of the old tunnels.
It was an old tunnel, something like that. There was a cookhouse down there. There was a regimental sergeant. It was a whole thing, you know.
Oh, proper hidden army.
It was a transit camp. But right down, and we was down there for a fortnight. We was allowed out every night about 5 o'clock after they'd sorted the flights out. And Then I was put on a flight to Fayed in the Canal Zone.
And where did you fly from?
We flew from Black Bush in Hampshire to start with. And we flew it on a Hermes. It held about 60 troops in the kit. And the seats were facing backwards, so if the plane crashed, you fell into your seat instead of tipping out of it. We was given a life jacket. The chap next door to me was called Jack Phillips, the next seat to me. He said, "Don't we get a parachute?" And after, there was a time difference, time zone, by the time we got to Egypt, we had to hold the clock. But from the time we left Black Bush, we stopped an hour in Malta for something to eat, and they filled the plane up with petrol, you know, refueling. Then got to Fayed, that was 14 hours, and this whole thing was a lumbering way there. We wasn't very high. You could see the tracks in the desert. You can almost see people. You know, not like nowadays when you're 5 miles high and can't see anything.
So was it the first time you'd been in a plane?
Yes.
So weren't you scared?
No.
Did it have windows, or is it one of those?
You had windows, didn't you? And we flew out to Fayed. It took about 14 hours, the whole lot. But as I said, there's a time change in it. I don't know whether it's backwards or forwards, can't remember. We stopped an hour in Malta. Malta was, I didn't like Malta much, of the humidity. It was like, that seemed real humid, Malta did. But when they got to Fayed in August, or was it early September, I was in Egypt 6 weeks before my 18th birthday, so that it would have been mid-August when I got to Egypt. And it stepped out of that aeroplane, that was like stepping into an oven. Right in the middle of the Egyptian summer. Yes, and we were still in our
winter kit from here.
Because at the depot we'd been kitted out with all tropical KD, khaki drill and all light stuff. So that was like stepping into an oven. So we then was picked up at Fayed and taken to our camp at Kibrit, which was about 12 miles along the canal. And we was just put in, it was a tented camp, we was in tents for the next 19 months.
Lovely.
It was, yes, talk about camp, yes. And for the next 19 months we was in tents. And
did you get the little beds or were you on the floor?
We had iron beds, and it was a really good camp because compared with other camps in the Canal Zone, a lot of them were stuck in the desert. But we had the great bit of lake on two sides of our camp. The great bit of lake is midway in between the canal, so one end of the canal goes into the lake while the ships stand there while the other lot passes.
Oh, come in.
Yeah. So halfway you've got the little bit of lake, the great bit of lake and Lake Timsa in between. But we got there, and then the next morning, I don't know if we were frightened or not. There's barbed wire everywhere. There's people marching about with rifles and Sten guns coming up from Fayed to Kibrit. There was a couple of roadblocks with people in the sort of foxholes with Bren guns
already
pointing at you, and yeah, through these checkpoints, and got to the camp, and there was regimental police. They was all bulled up, poshed up, and smart. So then we went to the next morning, I think there's about 12 of us, went to before the CEO, the commanding officer, and he said, you can be a driver operator, and you're going to be a BHQ trooper. But that was marvellous. That was a, all my army career was luck.
Oh, right.
It was luck I got the rash. It was luck I got the BHQ troop. Of course, the other three troops, Abel, Baker and Charlie, they used to take it in turns to do 3 days fatigue. So cook gives, general fatigue.
Camp thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And so BHQ, Battery Headquarters, didn't do that. So that was all right. And 181 Independent Light Battery was, they had 4.2 mortars, which would be about, I don't know, 3 or 4 miles perhaps from the front line. And
who were you actually fighting out there?
We wasn't, I don't know if we were fighting or not, but there was an emergency on, because from 51 to 54, the Egyptians were trying to get us off...
Out of Egypt.
Out of Egypt, yeah. So there were terrorists out there, and we'd done lots of roadblocks, patrols, camp guards for almost every other night for 19 months. We was on a duty as a camp guard, guarding the NAFI stores. There was a Ladysmith camp, which is a rat camp down in Fade we used to have to guard. Another guard we used to do, a terrible one, a general officer command, because you've got to be really smart to do it, guard him while he slept. And
presumably not in the tent.
Yes. So, and then we didn't come across much. We was on patrol one night, and the leading Land Rover got shot at. He had about 12 bullet holes in his front mudguard of the Land Rover. And what we done, we drove off the road and got down into a bit of a ditch, and we sort of stayed there until daylight. And we did report what had happened, and the Royal Marines came out from Moasca and
saved you.
No, they didn't know, actually. They just went round the village and see to find out where the gunmen were. We had to do that patrol because that was telephone lines, and they kept getting stolen.
Them.
Yeah. So with that, and so that was a fade, but it was really good on a great bit of lake, and I had some wonderful mates like Peter Stradwick, I'm still in touch with, John Reeves, I'm still in touch with, Ray Leask up in the Shetlands, and it was really good. And but we, with the trouble out there, we were sort of confined to camp for a lot of the time. If we went down to Fade, we went with armed escorts and to the Fade area, which was sort of barbed wired off.
Oh, right.
And we were fairly safe in there. There's a cinema and a few shops and that. And then Jeff Plunkett, Lieutenant Plunkett, my troop commander, asked me one day, I was still supposed to be trained to be this driver-operator. Driver-operator is somebody who can drive a vehicle and also use a
telephone,
19 set or a telephone, or lay cables. And so he said, will you run me to Fade? And I said yes, so I drove him to Fade in his Jeep.
Would you have had an option of saying no?
I suppose I could have done, but I didn't. Lieutenant Plunkett and I went to Fade. I must have done all right, because when I got back, he said, go to the office and get a pink slip, and I'll sign it. And a pink slip was a pass for a driving licence.
Oh, right.
So I came home with my pink slip later on and took it to Shah Hall and got a full driving licence.
So you've never done a test?
No, I had my driving test. No, he gave me the test in Egypt. Just a straight road. No traffic lights.
No three-point turns.
No. You were swimming around in the desert. Yeah. So that was that. But it was really, really good. And then, as I say, the trouble went on and on. But then in 1954, 1955, I think it was, they came to an agreement that the British troops would move out of Egypt. But since then, I've been joined the Suez Veterans. We've been going back because everybody has either forgot about it or don't know about it. From 51 to 55, there's about 1,000 British soldiers didn't come home.
All right.
There was 300 odd killed by terrorists. There was another 300 odd killed in accidents over that time. That seems a lot, but you've got to consider there was 80,000 British servicemen out there. There was army and lots of air force, a bit of navy in Portside, and there was something like 300 who died of diseases. You got out there, yes, and there was a lot. If you go around the cemeteries, lots of babies died. The married families were out there at one time. And one or two wives who died out there.
All right.
So people, when you talk about that, when you talk about the Suez Crisis, or the Suez, they think the Suez Crisis, which started in 56, but this is before 56, all this happened before 1955. And 1955, during that time, the 19 months I was out there, we was able to come home on leave. If we was a regular soldier, which I was, I think it cost about 90. If you got £90 for your plane fare.
Oh, what you had to pay?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Or else you did. Now they go abroad for about 6 months. That's a tour of duty. The tour of duty then was 3 years. So if you was a regular soldier, if you were left here, that was 3 years before you came home. Okay. And so I paid and.
So this is the money that you've earned from being a soldier?
Yeah. Yeah, and had a ton of money. One thing, I didn't smoke, and I didn't drink a lot of beer.
I thought cigarettes were handed out.
No, I think there was 9 and tuppence for 200.
Oh.
some ridiculous price. But I was able to save money, and... I think that was about £90, could have been 60, I can't really remember. And that, you go home for a month, and we flew home in what they called a York, and I think they was converted Lancaster bombers. And we flew to Stansted, then shipped up to Good Street, Deep Shelter.
Oh, right.
Went home from there on leave for a month, and...
So did your mother and that know you were coming home?
I don't know if I told them, but when I got home that morning, it was about 5:30, because I got to Cambridge Station, and I got a paper train, I think it was, from Cambridge to Burwell, or did I come on the... I can't really remember, but Dad was just getting up and Mum was in bed when I got home, and... I was home for a month, then went back to Stansted, as I say, back to the deep shelter. Then I went back to the deep shelter, then I went to Stansted and flew out again. But while I was home, I got what they call prickly heat. Oh, that was terrible.
What, because it was cold here?
Yeah, it's different temperature, yeah, prickly heat, and... You could feel it coming on, and you'd open your jacket, and there's like pins and needles all over you. You'd open your jacket, and by the time you got home, you'd nearly stripped to the waist. Yes, so that was all right. So I get back to Egypt, and then about 1955, they decided we was coming home as a unit, and we moved to Salisbury Plain. For about 6 or 7 months, or perhaps 9 months, came home on a troop ship. Flew out on an aeroplane, come back on a troop ship. That was an experience, a troop ship. about 3,000 soldiers.
Oh, on one ship?
On one ship, yeah. Seasick, some of them were. Oh, they were sick and bad. One bloke, I forget his name, but his first name was George, and he laid on the deck, and he went green with it. And it was fun. Every morning we used to have boat drill. When you put your life jackets on, you
know. Oh, right, in case you...
Boat stations, I think they're called. And
would have been threatening to sink the ship?
No.
Or was it just...
That was just in... Yeah, because before I came home on Empire Ken, the Empire Windrush caught fire in the Mediterranean. Four of the crew were killed and all the rest got off at Algiers or somewhere. So, you know, in case anything, in case you have to abandon ship, and your life jacket then was a big lump of cork on your chest and a big lump of cork on your back tied with two tapes. And the instruction was, if you have to jump over the side, hold the cork down because that would come up and break your neck. And yes, and we was all these boat stations. You had to parade up on the deck, and our sergeant major was giving us our daily telling off. What a scruffy lot we was, and that, and a great big wave come up right over the shore, and he had his back to it, and he got drenched. And as I said, that was fun. Yeah.
What, so you lot, what, dodged it or just watched it?
He got most of it. We got some of it. But, yes. And then we disembarked at Southampton, had some more leave of, I think, about 3 weeks. Then we got down, made our way back to Tidworth. Tidworth, then we...
Where's Tidworth?
Tidworth's on Salisbury Plain. Oh. We were at Tidworth... for a few weeks, then we went to a camp at Bulford, and I got demobbed from Bulford. And as I say, I still keep in touch with my army mates. While we were at Tidworth, we were still doing things as soldiers do, training. We was training on Salisbury Plain. That was a time of the 4-day warning. We was atom bombs. We was.
Oh, right.
We had 2 or 3 days digging holes in Salisbury Plain so we could get in case a bomb dropped, digging big holes so that the front of the vehicles could drive into them and be sheltered. That was on Salisbury Plain. We'd done exercises. And then we'd done a camp at Brecon, at the Brecon Beacons. That was terribly cold there. That was so cold. In them days, you didn't have antifreeze like you've got now. It was just water in your radiators. And every hour during the night, somebody went round and started the vehicles up so that they didn't freeze. And that's how cold it was. And we were sleeping under lorries or sleeping wherever we could. We got everything wrapped round us to keep us warm, camouflage nets, great coats. And we was there, I don't know, a fortnight, I should think. It wasn't that cold all the time. It was one or two really, really cold nights. And that was the Brecon Beacons. Then we came back to Bulford, where I got demobbed from.
And did you get your demob suit?
Yes, I did. I got on the train and got Aldershot. I wish I'd have saved it. I don't know. Had a Trilby hat. Had trousers and a jacket and a shirt. I think there's some shoes as well.
All right. And did you have to exchange your army uniform, or did you keep your army uniform as well?
I left when I got demobbed. I took my kit down to the quartermaster's stores, and he said, tip it out on the floor. So I tipped 2 kit bags up and all the other stuff. He said, is there anything you want? I said, no. I wish I'd kept a lot now.
Yeah.
Don't know, and I'd got my civilian clothes on, which we wore when we was in England, when we wasn't on duty, and so and then I called into Aldershot and got this here did mob suit and a cardboard box, and then come home. Yes.
And were they happy to see you?
But I don't know. Probably there wasn't.
So they didn't have a party and banners in the street or anything?
Oh no, they didn't. All the village was national servicemen. All my mates were. So I don't think there's many parties and banners in the street.
Oh, right.
No. And, then Burwell boys, see that? There were several served in Korea, Egypt, Malaya, everywhere. Right. There's hot spots. So there's sort of Burwell, I'd say. One got killed in Korea, didn't he? Francis Holder.
I know there's one down on the War Memorial.
Yeah, that's Francis Holder. And he also lost a brother in the Second World War, Alan Holder.
Oh, right.
Two brothers there. Yeah. Yeah. Can you excuse me here? Switch that thing off a minute. I've got to go to the
look.
Anyway, that's 7:15.
You haven't got long then.
And I've got to tell you tomorrow, haven't I?
Yes.